Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 47. Hi, I'm Jake, and I'm flying solo on the podcast this week. This is being recorded in advance because we'll be camping in New Hampshire during the weekend it's released. In fact, this is the fourth podcast we've written and recorded in the past 2 weeks, so I'll be glad to take some time off. However, we know you need your fix, so it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history. Monday is September 25th, and on September 25th, 1690, the first newspaper was published in Boston. Public Occurrences, both foreign and domestic, wasn't just the first newspaper for our little town, it was the first paper published in North America. The editor, Benjamin Harris, had emigrated to Boston after his attempts at printing pamphlets back in England got him locked up for sedition. He hoped he'd have better luck with a newspaper in the far-flung provincial backwater of Boston. That first edition carried news that the recent smallpox epidemic that killed 320 Bostonians had come to an end. The smallpox, which has been raging in Boston after a manner very extraordinary, is now very much abated. It is thought that far more have been sick of it than were visited with it when it raged so much 12 years ago. Nevertheless, it has not been so mortal. The number of them that have died in Boston by this last visitation is about 320, which is not perhaps half so many as fell by the former visitation. It also noted a day of Thanksgiving in a neighboring colony. The Christianized Indians in some parts of Plymouth have newly appointed a day of thanksgiving to God for his mercy in supplying their extreme and pinching necessities under their late want of corn, and for his giving them now a prospect of a very comfortable harvest. Their example may be worth mentioning. Most of all, though, it detailed the ongoing skirmishes between the English, French, and the respective Native American allies all along the New England frontier. Somewhat surprisingly, it even calls out atrocities committed by English commanders. Two English captives escaped from the hands of the Indians and French came into Portsmouth on the 16th instant, and say that when Captain Mason was at Port Real, he cut the faces and ripped the bellies of two Indians, and threw a third overboard in the sight of the French, who, informing the other Indians of it, they have in revenge barbarously butchered 40 captives of ours that were in their hands. Harris told subscribers that he intended to publish the little newsletter monthly, but that would not be the case. Just 4 days after that first edition went out, the royal government of the colony pronounced that they do hereby manifest and declare their high resentment and disallowance of said pamphlet, and order that the same be suppressed and called in. Perhaps it was as simple as not getting the proper licenses, but maybe they weren't too pleased to see news of Captain Mason's crimes printed publicly. Either way, the first edition of Public Occurrences would also be the last. Benjamin Harris would eventually return to Old England and found the London Post. In response to what was perceived as an epidemic of suicides among LGBT youth, Republican Governor Bill Weld formed the nation's first Commission on Gay and Lesbian Youth in 1992. As it was described at the time, "The Commission's mandate is the prevention of gay and lesbian youth suicide, violence prevention, and creating school environments where gay and lesbian students can feel safe and where harassment is not tolerated. The Commission is empowered to make recommendations to the Governor and to state and private agencies about the creation of programs and policies on behalf of gay and lesbian students in Massachusetts. As expressed by the governor in the preamble to the executive order, abolishing prejudice and discrimination against gay and lesbian youth is the goal and charge of this commission." Through their efforts, legislation was passed protecting gay youth in 1993. On September 26, 1996, the commission made another key recommendation. "The Governor's Commission on Gay and Lesbian Youth recommends 1. That the governor and state legislature increase funding in order that every high school in Massachusetts can receive a grant to help them form a gay-straight alliance. 2. That high school principals and superintendents ensure that school handbooks, disciplinary codes, and anti-discrimination policies include student sexual orientation in accordance with Massachusetts law. 3. That parents in Massachusetts come out in support of gay-straight alliances in their communities and assist in the formation of new gay-straight alliances. 4. That every high school in Massachusetts, which does not have a gay-straight alliance, form one. Presently, 25% of Massachusetts high schools have gay-straight alliances. In 1992, only one or two high schools had GSAs. In 1996, 75 of the state's 300 high schools have GSAs. Testimony from students at commission hearings and events pointed GSAs as being the single most important factor in preventing student dropout and youth suicide. Action item. The Governor's Commission will conduct student leadership trainings and outreach statewide to help form new GSAs. It has been through the work of the Gay-Straight Alliances that the most significant changes statewide have taken place. The document then lists a dozen accomplishments by Massachusetts GSAs, concluding with, "These are just a few examples of the positive work that schools and students across the state have done to make their schools safe for gay, lesbian, and bisexual students. We envision a future in which every school in the Commonwealth and every student in the Commonwealth can study, learn, and grow in a safe environment, free from harassment and discrimination, whatever their sexual orientation." That may have been overly optimistic about the future, but we still think Massachusetts has a lot to be proud of. Wednesday is September 27th. When James Madison died in 1836, it had been nearly 20 years since he served as President of the United States. In a eulogy given at Faneuil Hall on September 27, 1836, John Quincy Adams remembered how Madison had spent the final years of his retirement as rector of the University of Virginia and president of an agricultural society in his home county. In the midst of these occupations, the declining days of the philosopher, the statesman, and the patriot were past, until the 28th day of June last, the anniversary of the day on which the ratification of the Convention of Virginia in 1788 had affixed the seal of James Madison as the father of the Constitution of the United States, when his earthly part sunk without a struggle into the grave, and a spirit, bright as the seraphim that surround the throne of omnipotence, ascended to the bosom of his God. This Constitution, my countrymen, is the great result of the North American Revolution. This is the giant stride in the improvement of the condition of the human race, consummated in a period of less than 100 years. Of the signers of the address to George III in Congress in 1774, of the signers of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, of the signers of the Articles of Confederation in 1781, and of the signers of the Federal and National Constitution of Government under which we live, with enjoyments never before allotted to man, not one remains in the land of the living. The last survivor of them all was he to honor whose memory we are here assembled at once with mourning and with joy. John Quincy Adams, of course, was a son of the founding generation, and himself a former president, lending his comments a particular air of melancholy poignance. On September 28, 1960, legendary Red Sox hitter Ted Williams played his last major league game. John Updike wrote an article for The New Yorker titled, "Hub Fans Bid Kid Adieu," in which he recapped Williams' mercurial career, then described the experience of witnessing his last game, and the breathless moment when Ted Williams stepped up to the plate for the last time. Understand that we were a crowd of rational people. We knew that a home run cannot be produced at will. The right pitch must be perfectly met, and luck must ride with the ball. Three innings before, we had seen a brave effort fail. The air was soggy, the season was exhausted. Nevertheless, there will always lurk, around a corner in a pocket of our knowledge of the odds, an indefensible hope. And this was one of the times, which you now and then find in sports, when a density of expectation hangs in the air and plucks an event out of the future. Fisher, after his unsettling wait, was wide with the first pitch. He put the second one over, and Williams swung mightily and missed. The crowd grunted, seeing that classic swing, so long and smooth and quick, exposed, naked in its failure. Fisher threw a third time. Williams swung again, and there it was. The ball climbed on a diagonal line into the vast volume of air over center field. From my angle behind third base, the ball seemed less an object in flight than the tip of a towering, motionless construct, like the Eiffel Tower or the Tappan Zee Bridge. It was in the books while it was still in the sky. Brandt ran back to the deepest corner of the outfield grass. The ball descended beyond his reach and struck in the crotch where the bullpen met the wall, bounced chunkily, and, as far as I could see, vanished. Like a feather caught in a vortex, Williams ran around the square of bases at the center of our beseeching screaming. He ran, as he always ran out home runs, hurriedly, unsmiling, head down. as if our praise were a storm of rain to get out of. He didn't tip his cap, though we thumped, wept, and chanted, "We want Ted," for minutes after he hid in the dugout. He did not come back. Our noise for some seconds passed beyond excitement into a kind of immense open anguish, a wailing, a cry to be saved. But immortality is non-transferable. The papers said that the other players and even the umpires on the field begged him to come out and acknowledge us in some way, but he never had and did not now. Gods do not answer letters. Friday is September 29th. After a merchant sold military supplies to the occupying British troops, the Boston Committee of Correspondence wrote to the First Continental Congress on September 29th, 1774, explaining how cooler heads were barely able to prevent a riot among Boston's patriotic citizens. Yesterday, it appeared that Joseph Scott Esquire had sold to the army a number of cannon, some coehorns, shells, chain, and other shot. Upon the matter being discovered and Mr. Scott's being acquainted with the resentments of the people, he forbade the party who were sent for them to take them away. They nevertheless proceeded and carried them on board their ships. This created much disturbance, and a guard was offered to Mr. Scott by the general. But Mr. Scott was informed that no military guard could save him, and would but stimulate the people to acts of greater violence. Many gentlemen, who foresaw what must have ensued, endeavored to dissuade the people from attacking the house, and finally, some persons engaged that if no guard was set to the house, they would do all in their power to disperse the people. This was complied with, and the exertions of the gentlemen of the town proved effectual, some dirt and filth thrown upon his warehouse being all the injury he sustained. We have given an account of this affair because we expect some untrue representation will be made, perhaps much to the disadvantage of the town. After the Massachusetts militia's glorious victory over the French fortress at Louisburg during the Seven Years' War, they settled into a monotonous occupation. However, as their officers from the regular army refused to honor the terms of their enlistments, tempers flared. Members of the Massachusetts militia enlisted voluntarily under contracts that bound both sides in an agreement. The province agreed to provide supplies and to maintain certain conditions, while the men agreed to serve for a certain number of months. However, as the period of service expired amongst the militia at Louisbourg, the British officers refused to honor their discharges. With the army shorthanded, the militia would have to stay no matter what their enlistment papers said. This violated the Yankee sensibility, which held that a contract entered into between men was only a short remove from the covenant they entered into with God. That resentment is clear in Private Gibson Clow's diary. 30th September, 1759. Cold weather. We hear a great talk of things uncertain, and thus time spins away, and so we spend our day. Cold weather is coming on apace, which will make us look round about us and put on our winter clothing, and we shall stand in need of good liquors for to keep our spirits on cold winter's days. And we, being here within stone walls, are not likely to get liquors or clothes at this time of the year. And although we be Englishmen born, we are debarred Englishmen's liberty. Therefore, we now see what it is to be under martial law, and to be with the regulars, who are but little better than slaves to their officers. And when I get out of their power, I shall take care of how I get into it again. With their enlistments up, and their promised provisions nowhere to be seen, the provincials garrisoning Louisbourg began to mutiny and desert en masse. If that sounds familiar, it's because it helped to inspire this scene from the film Last of the Mohicans.
British promises are honored, and the militia will not be released, because I need more definite proof than this man's word.
Nathaniel's word's been good on this frontier a long time before you got here.
This meeting is over. The militia stays.
Does the rule of English law no longer govern? Has it been replaced by absolutism?
If English law cannot be trusted, maybe these people would do better making their own peace with the French.
That is sedition!
For those that remained, resentment would fester for nearly two decades, and would help feed the tensions that led to the American Revolution. Finally, Sunday is October 1st, if you can believe it. After baseball's American League and National League feuded bitterly for years over who would be the dominant professional league, they finally made peace in 1903. They agreed to a set of rules that would govern both leagues, agreed to stop recruiting each other's players, and appointed a national commission to oversee their compliance. With both leagues enjoying a banner summer, they agreed to meet in a world championship. On October 1, 1903, some 16,000 fans turned out to watch the first modern World Series game between the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Boston Americans. It was played at the Huntington Avenue grounds, a former ballpark that stood on the land now occupied by the Northeastern University campus. Despite Cy Young's dominant pitching for the Americans, Pittsburgh won that first game. The Americans won the next night, but they were defeated again on the third. After three games in Pittsburgh, the final game of the series was played at the Huntington Avenue grounds, with the Americans clinching the first World Series victory at 5-3. If you'd like to learn more about any of our anniversaries this week, check out the show notes at hubhistory.com/047. We'll have pictures, videos, articles, and original sources for all the stories I discussed. If you want to get in touch with us, email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, make sure you hit the subscribe link and never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, we'd love it if you would rate and review the show. That's all for now. We'll be back next week.